Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen Monday night, we'll be discussing it on Wednesday. But as we've come to do every single day since March of 2020, we begin our show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I'm going to mention something because of our first guest. I want people to check out Ken Burns' wonderful documentary entitled The Statue of Liberty, because in 1985, he actually interviewed twins, the Vindman twins,
wow,
at the Statue of Liberty. And someday I'm going to grab Ken, not you, Ken Barnes, but Ken Burns, who I know also very well, and say, how did you find them? How did you find them? And how proud are you of looking at Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during that impeachment hearing, when he was the voice of courage, the voice of patriotism, and he understood what it meant to speak truth to power. So with that, now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Why did I mention Ken Burns and PBS? Because I got pitched a story about something that was going to be happening on Frontline on PBS. And I get pitched a lot of stuff. But I thought, let me look into this. And then I looked into this, and I have to tell my first guest that in some ways I'm terrified of interviewing you because I'm so impressed by what you have done with your life and the documentaries that you have produced. The reason you are joining us today is that tonight, Tuesday night, which is when this will air, The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden, an election year frontline series will begin airing. And for those of you who don't know about this, you write, before the votes are cast this November, as it has for every election since 1988, Frontline will present The Choice, its critically acclaimed election year special, offering interwoven investigative biographies of both major party candidates. The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden, tells the story of a deeply divided nation through the lives of the two men who want to lead it. So let me welcome Michael Kirk, the producer and director of this Frontline series, to The Attitude. Thank you so much for finding the time.
It's a real pleasure. And that's a great open to your show. It's amazing.
We've been doing it for, I mean, that I thought to do it, I don't know, but I was so moved. And when he said, it's okay, Papa, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And I knew that it wouldn't. I needed to almost value him even more.
Yes.
So before we get into The Choice, I decided that in anticipation of interviewing you, I was going to sort of look at your history. And I decided that if I ever retire from doing this gig, I want to teach a course. And the course is going to be based on 26 hours of documentaries that you have done.
Wow.
And I looked at the last 4 years, and I just want to share with my audience just a couple of them so they understand why I am saying this. So I'm going to go back to 2016, Michael. And in 2016, you have President Trump, the personal story of Donald Trump. The Choice, 2016, Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. Then you go into 2017, Putin's revenge, the history of grievances that led to the Putin-led disruption of the 2016 election. Bannon's war, Trump's road to the White House, divided states of America. We're only at 2017. Then in 2018, McCain, the political biography of Senator John McCain, Trump's takeover, Trump's showdown, and you just go on and on and on. And as I'm looking at all these different films, I realize, oh my God, they're a roadmap for a course. That you start with your fabulous pieces, and then you just bring in other voices and other readings. And it talks about an America in decline. Mm. That's how I felt. As I was looking at every one of them, I saw a headline from a piece about a year ago, and it was entitled, How to Ruin a Superpower. And I felt like that's another title for a lot of what you have sort of showed us in your Frontline series. So let's get to what we're going to start seeing on Tuesday night, which is the choice. And what frightens me a little bit about this 2 hours is that there's a line in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. And Donald Trump is a bleeder. Everything about him is an attractive nuisance. Everything about him forces you to want to sort of look and see and smell and touch. Joe Biden, on the other hand, feels a little bit like wallpaper. Like he's predictable and he's nice and he's empathetic and he's been there for a long time. So I see the challenge of these two men is how do you do justice to telling their story? Because it really is a story of a divided America. But one seems to be something you can't take your eyes off of. And the other one, you want to encourage people to understand why they have to see it, even though it's not as sexy and disruptive, but yet it may be more important for your life.
Well, you've stated the dilemma of the filmmaker, the storyteller. And, you know, we sort of knew that was what was facing us, that you're going to make a film called The Choice 2020, and you're going to have Trump. And before we even knew it was Biden, Trump and anyone else, Elizabeth Warren, anybody else, Trump's going to, has the potential to suck up all the oxygen in the room. So, but the beauty of the films are the choices that many years ago, we figured out that if you weave the two biographies, so you go as far back as you can, you base the whole film on personality as destiny and the boy is the father of the man. Mm-hmm. So you know you've in the, that gender issue will present itself to me in 4 years, I think. But for right now, I can still say the boy is the father of the man. Yeah. So you know that it's going to be an arc, the narrative arc of a character, of two characters, and you know you're going to weave them, and you know you're probably, because they're in their 70s, you're going to start in the 50s, and you're going to work your way forward, and there will be all kinds of national events which will occur that are going to be interesting. Maybe you just hint to them as you go by. But most importantly, you say to yourself, how can I level the playing field a little bit so that it's interesting because it's about something other than making noise or not making noise? Trump's very good at making noise. Biden's not so good at making noise. How do you get them both to be, Biden to be making a little more noise, Trump to be making a little less noise? And we did it this way. We believe that the crisis in America, the pandemic, the racial reckoning, the economic collapse, the fires in the West and the floods in the East, the pollution everywhere, all of it was a crisis of epic proportions for all Americans, certainly for the world, but for all Americans as they face the consequence of an election. So we thought, let's measure. So that's the national crisis. That's the mindset of the viewer.
Absolutely.
And you've got two men who are sort of asking to lead us at this time. Two starkly different men on the surface and obviously. But how do you tell a story that that might inform people in on a new dimension? And the way we decided to do it was that we would pick 8 crisis points in each of their lives, 8 moments where these men confronted crisis and developed some response to it. And from it, added to the thing that is at the heart of both biographies always in The Choice, which is a life method, the accumulation of a life method, a way of doing things in life. And you get it piece by piece from childhood all the way up. And our job was to zero in on the crisis, then what was the life method? Donald picked up, Joey picked up, and carried with them through a series of subsequent crises, modifying, morphing, hardening, becoming what they became. So that when you watch now, just the latest, the last couple of scenes, the coronavirus, Joe's primary victory in South Carolina, Donald's handling of, I call them by their first names because they're characters to me, not presidents. I have to do it that way, just to make them human in my own mind. And the racial reckoning after George Floyd's murder. So you see Trump's responses, and what I've done is reverse engineer those responses. He never apologizes. He's always attacked. He name calls. He does all the things he does. Where does that come from? What is the genesis and the root? So that people can watch it and say, I get it.
But Michael, you had so much material. You've a lot of material about Joe Biden because he's been on a political stage in perpetuity. He's been there since he was a young man. So there was a lot of that, but it's always in a lot of ways through the elected political lens.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, however, had a love affair with everything that put him on the front page of anything, whether it was the Post, whether it was the News, whether it was The Apprentice. It had to always be about him. So you had such incredible material. And as I was thinking of how you would do this, Trump ate a party. Trump literally took over the GOP. There is no more GOP. It is now the Trump Party.
It is
a party that is now in his image. I think they thought that they would, I think there was a line that you wrote that from another one of your documentaries, that they just wanted a pen in the White House. So these very smart GOP people thought, oh, he's going to be our boy. He's going to just basically sign and, you know, we'll let him play golf and he'll just sign the stuff that we send him. What must be so incredibly shocking to them was that, in fact, they disappeared and he enveloped them. That is just what's so remarkable.
Where is Paul Ryan now?
Exactly. I don't know. I don't even, what does he look like? I mean, you know, where is Paul Ryan now? My question is, what about Biden and the Democratic Party? I understand Trump and what is now the Trump Party, but how do we describe Biden vis-a-vis the Democratic Party? I've always said, and I know Joe, I've always said that Joe leads from behind, that he becomes the moment. He's not the leader of the event, but he becomes the moment. As you looked at the choice, how do you see Biden as this alternative to Trump? And how would you define that alternative?
So we begin with little Joey in Wilmington, bad stutter. It's the 50s, the early 50s. He's humiliated, made fun of, bullied. Even a nun takes him on. His mom fixes that, Jean fixes that. But little Joey, he still gets guys to like him, but it's because he does kind of dangerous, crazy, risky things as a little kid. He's laughed at. He's afraid of it. It makes him mad. He's got a real temper. That little boy goes into a room with a mirror and a flashlight and reads Yeats, cleans himself up, teaches himself to not stutter, still has it to this day, still worries about it every day and every speech. It's why I think he talks so much. He could talk finally. It's why he goes to the middle of the road. He wants everybody to like him. It's why in Anita Hill, he wants Anita to like him and Clarence to like him. He knows he's trapped. The black thing is complicated for him because he's made close friends in the black neighborhood in Wilmington. In 72, when he runs, it's the black vote that wins it for him by less than 3,000 votes. He's got them. And it's not because he promises him anything. The thing about Biden over his life is he has no ideology, really. He's a good guy. He's a Democrat.
it becomes the moment. If you just prove my point, he has right. no theology. So as the moment changes, he sort of senses
Joe's the moment. There with it. So you need a crime bill? I'm there with a crime bill. Oh, it locked people up? Oh my God, how did that happen? You know, I tried to be fair to Anita and I tried to be fair to Clarence. And in the end, I vote no for Clarence, but I've now angered the vast majority of Black women who I thought were my constituency and white women who are part of the women's movement that say, wait a minute, it's all burgeoning. And suddenly I'm responsible as sitting as the head of the panel of all white men with Strom Thurmond on one side and Teddy Kennedy on the other. What could be more allegorical, right? And there he is. I mean, that's our Joe, right? He has the unbelievable tragedy of Nelia's death and Naomi's death and his two boys being crushed. He considers suicide. He comes back. He rides the train into Washington every day, and Val, his sister and campaign manager, watches the kids. He drags himself through. So what does he do? What does he learn to do at Anita Hill? What does he learn to do when he plagiarizes and gets caught in the Kinnock thing? Kinnock, what is Kinnock? He's finding a life story because he doesn't have one that he thinks he can sell. So he sells a British politician, a Welsh politician's Labour Party movement story that he sees on video and gets caught at it. And what does he do? And this is a very different thing than what Donald does. He apologizes. He admits the mistake. He perseveres. He persevered through stuttering. He persevered through Nelia's death. He keeps pushing. And by 2007, he decides to run again in Iowa, although he's not a national politician. He doesn't have any love out in America. He's viewed as this kind of goofy guy who plagiarized and, you know, talks too much and all of that. Everybody kind of makes fun of him, including Obama. And then he says this weirdly racist feeling thing about Obama. He's clean and presentable. And Obama, you know, and everybody falls apart and his campaign falls apart. What does he do? He apologizes to Obama. He gets close to him, as close as he can. He perseveres. And what happens? Obama, in a gesture that is designed to show a lot of whites that he's not that kind of a Black guy who bears a grudge. He picks Joe as his vice president for other reasons as well. Right. And Joe does it because his mother tells him to, and because he didn't want to do it. And his mom says, are you kidding me? The first Black president, he might actually win, and he wants you to be his vice president, and you're not going to support him and help him? You know, we interviewed Ted Kaufman, and he said, game, set, match. You know, there was no question that he was going to do it, and he does it. And as a result of being Obama's vice president, what does Joe Biden get? He gets what they call the Obama halo. It's a free pass in the Anita Hill case, in the gaffe about Obama himself, in the crime bill.
Such a gift.
Now with Strom Thurmond, all of it gets washed away. And if Beau hadn't died, he would have run against Hillary and maybe won and maybe not. And he doesn't come back. He's done. He's 50 years are over until he sees Charlottesville. And then he says, I'm going back in. You know, 70-year-old Joe Biden going back, a step slow, you know, maybe not all of his marbles, but maybe enough of them.
Michael Kirk, I love you already because now you've told me how I can watch The Choice and I can get so much content about both of them because you have just made my wallpaper exciting. Good. You've made my wallpaper human. You've made my wallpaper something I want to hug, you know? And as I'm listening to you, John McCain was a friend of mine, believe it or not. I mean, Arnie Arneson.
I like John McCain too.
So you did a piece about John McCain, and as I'm listening to you, there's a story about John McCain that I know personally seems to sound a little bit about Joe. And there is something about the Joes of this world and the McCains of this world that I want people to understand why that defines leadership. And McCain, remember when McCain was running, and I think it was at the very beginning of 2008, he was the anointed. He had money, he had name recognition, everyone thought he was a slam dunk. Well, within a couple of months of that, he was literally dragging himself into New Hampshire. I mean, it was 2007, but it was
and they were broke.
They're broke. Okay. So he comes back to New Hampshire because this is a place where he needs to regroup, because this is a place that totally loves him, because he remembered what happened in 2000. And I had gotten to know him incredibly well in 2000. So he tells his only two staff, I think, that were still on the payroll, that he wants to be on a TV show with Arnie Arneson. And they're looking at him like, what are you, crazy? That liberal progressive? Why would you want to do this? He goes, no, I know her. And so John comes on the set and his two aides are sitting out here. And I said to John, now we know each other really well. And I said to John, John, you're crawling back into New Hampshire. You have no money. People have abandoned you. They've gone to Newt Gingrich. I said, your campaign is in shambles. I said, I have to ask you, John, now this is on television. If you can't run a campaign, how the hell do you run a country? And you had to watch your staff like almost go through the glass. Okay, they were like, see, we told you you shouldn't have been on with her. But John knows me so well. Yeah. And he knows I'm not saying it because I don't admire him. I'm saying it because someone had to say it out loud to him. And it might as well be me.
Wow, good.
And John gets quiet, doesn't get angry. And then he says, you're absolutely right, Arnie. He said, but you know, during the course of a presidency, you will make mistakes. And the question about leadership is about whether you will recognize the mistake, you will own it, and you will figure out how to rehabilitate it and fix it. That's the real test of leadership, Arnie, is whether you can do this. He said, watch me. I can do this. And as you were describing Joe Biden and the things and the mistakes he had made and his willingness to acknowledge it, his willingness to embrace it, his willingness to, and therefore be able to get beyond it, to really become a leader. As you were telling me that, I think of McCain. And that's why I loved him. I'm politically not like him, but I could so admire him. And what you've just described about Joe makes me say, it's okay. You can admire him too. Sometimes it's a bit milquetoast. Sometimes it's too middle for me. Sometimes it's too safe. But again, because of the moment we live in, as you pointed out, the pandemic and climate change and Black Lives Matter, the moment is going to demand something more than just the middle. And I think he can read that. Now, how the H do you cover Trump?
Well,
I just feel like it should be R-rated. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do you cover him? Because we seem to know so much about him. What could you add to the story?
Well, this was the question. But of course, if you say we're going to introduce the idea of crisis, so we're going to give Trump a crisis in 8 different places, and we're going to see what the effect of the crisis was on him. Now, understand that one of the things that Trump eventually, so he has a crisis as a little kid. It's a really bad life. It's a terrible, dysfunctional home he lives in with terrible lessons being taught. Mom away from him. He's 2.5 and she is very sick and she disappears. She comes back, but by then there's no connection. And we've talked to lots of people and we tell people in the film that this is, and his niece, Mary, we talked to her for a long, long time on camera. This is where the lack of commitment to women, the lack of connection to other people, and especially women, comes from. You see a parade of photos of women he's connected and not connected with, 3 wives, the whole deal. So you learn that. You learn that the father, who then takes care of him, is unbelievably stern, awful, paranoid, racist, all of the things that are the things we fear the most about Donald Trump. When you talk to lots of people, they say, well, I love the guy, or I like him, or he's a friend of mine, but you know, he's got this and he's got that. And he even he says, I'm a wrecking ball. I'm not a regular human being. I'm something else. So he knows. So if you've got that set up, and then you introduce into that mix at 23, a guy named Roy Cohn, who we all know about, who hands a playbook over. They form a relationship which is not client, whatever. It's not teacher, student. It's something else. And it's real close. And Cohn gives him the life playbook that says, cause a crisis. The time you will succeed is in a crisis. When New York is about to go bankrupt, are in that crisis, and Trump needs $400 million to build the Commodore Hotel. Cohn goes in behind closed doors with Abe Beame and others and makes it happen. Trump is doing the other stuff, watching all this kind of dirty deed stuff happening, and he's learning. He's not dumb. He gets it.
No, I know.
Crisis, attached to a crisis, stir it up, make it worse. Look at the Central Park Five. What is that? Another crisis for Donald Trump. Where does he learn to do it? So the other piece we had to add, though, is why when the coronavirus comes along, and we know now that he's telling Woodward for pure reasons of vanity, I can win Bob Woodward over. I'll just tell him that on the one hand, I know, but on the other hand, I'm fooling the people, and he's going to appreciate and love me for that, or whatever he's doing. In doing that, Donald is proving to us that he doesn't trust experts. He doesn't like the FBI. He doesn't like the Justice Department. He doesn't like the judges on the Supreme Court, right? So where does that hatred of experts come from? And I would take you back, and I do in the film, to the marble collegiate palace in a church in Manhattan, Cathedral in Manhattan, and Norman Vincent Peale, the minister who runs it and wrote the famous book, Power of Positive Thinking. Donald's father, a big believer in Power of Positive Thinking, and Norman Vincent Peale. Then the church was the headquarters for socialites, politicians like Nixon and others, and the Trumps. Young Donald, stuck in his brain, positive thinking, positive thinking. So as he's building the casinos, and experts, Wall Street, the press are saying, it's gonna go down. There's no way you can make this work, Donald. You know, he is ignoring it. He is believing in the positive vision of Norman Vincent Peale. And as I made that scene, I said, okay, I'm going to stick a little bit of the coronavirus, which we do more fully at the end of the film, right in here at the end of the casino section. So you can hear the same words. It's going away. It's going to be magic. It's going to be all right. My ego can get us through it.
A miracle. It's going to be a miracle, right?
That's right. A miracle. Right. Oh my, so I got to ask a question. As you were looking at these eight sort of different sort of opportunities where they had to sort of face challenge, how did he not end up in jail? I gotta ask. I mean, no bank would loan him money. Everybody knows he was.
Yes, they would. Oh, yes, they would. They made him go bankrupt, but they put him on a budget, which he immediately got off of.
I know.
It was only $400,000 a month, but they gave him a budget. But essentially, if he would put his name on the buildings, he just took, this is positive thinking, absolute humiliation and devastation, 6 or 7 bankruptcies of his casinos.
I know.
And what did he do? He turned himself into a celebrity. He turned Plan B, celebrity, got him the job playing a mogul on television, The Apprentice, which put him in American households for 14 years as a powerful figure. Playing a mogul. He was a failed mogul, and now he's playing one, the part of a lifetime, and his life had prepared him for that part.
Well, I always tell people that was the problem. We knew Donald Trump. He'd been in our living rooms for over a decade. Right. This was not, you were not a set. And we loved the idea that he could fire people. We loved the idea of success. And frankly, everybody was so ticked off at Congress, they wanted them fired anyway.
Absolutely.
In fact, it's interesting. Republicans always run against government, but you know, the Democrats didn't deliver. So there were people on the Democratic side that, we can fire them too. So in a way, he was the perfect vessel for what ended up showing up against Hillary Clinton. And it always amazes me that Donald Trump walked in with the highest negatives, I guess, in Pew history when they were doing negatives, but Hillary Clinton came in at the second highest. And I'm thinking, but for him, it was the negative we knew because of the living room he had been in. Oh my God, Michael Kirk.
Way, Steve Bannon calls him, Bannon and Sessions used to call him the imperfect vessel, not the perfect vessel. He was the imperfect vessel. You could aim him, You never knew if he was going to fire straight or not. And they used him to, of course, bring immigration and.
And I got to let you go. I don't want to let you go. I want you back. I want you back all the time. Everyone, tonight, the choice, 2020, Trump versus Biden, the election year frontline series on PBS. It's not just a one-shot deal. You can watch it online. You can watch it. We're getting you back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. I think we need to get away from the advertisement and the lies and the whatever, and we need a story. Yeah. We need a story because stories are really what persuade people and what enlighten people. Yeah. What you've done with the choice is given us a story, not this piecemeal thing, but the gestalt. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for doing what you do. And thank you for joining us on the air. I really appreciate it. And I'll tell Rick Smith I got a chance to talk to you.
There you go. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye. You're welcome.
Thank you, Ken.
This is the edition of The Attitude. We'll be right back.
Wow.
Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone this is going to be heard on Tuesday, but we Zoom on Monday afternoon. So what is one of my favorite sources of content? The conversation.
Conversation.
Oh my God, we mine it and mine it and mine it. And in part because I'm so grateful. I know a lot of professors I have taught at different schools around the country. And you know, you publish or perish and you have to write these huge treatises, but a lot of them are so valuable because their level of expertise is important, but yet they don't have a platform to actually share that level of expertise. And what the conversation has done is found professors and PhDs and helped them write these sort of magazine-y type articles or these op-ed type articles that really sort of taps into their area of expertise. And as a result, people like Arnie get to have these fabulous people with this real knowledge about certain areas that really need to be discussed at a time, especially a time like this. So that is my introduction to Professor Timothy Rich from Western Kentucky University. He's a political science professor with a focus in part on election reform. And the reason I say that is this was the title of his piece. As concerns mount over the integrity of US elections, so does support for international poll monitors. So Timothy, I read your piece and I actually pulled a nugget out of your piece and I Facebooked it. And what made me so happy was a poll that you did at your school that asked people about whether they wanted international monitors to oversee this election. And what I thought was such a celebration of people wanting to trust the results was that over 70% of those that you polled said yes, and it was a vast majority of Democrats and Republicans. And that means they want a result too they can trust, no matter what Donald Trump says. So with that, tell us a little bit about this international poll monitoring, how it's been used in other countries, and how it could or could not be used in the United States, because I want another set of eyes looking at it other than Democrats and Republicans and their lawyers.
Sure, so international observers, usually when we think of international observers, we're thinking about younger democracies.
Yes.
Countries that have just recently transitioned or for some sort of crisis, that's why they're bringing international observers. But for many cases, it's just to sort of, make the public feel more comfortable about an election in a time of crisis, even in a more stable democracy. So the various different international organizations, they vary in terms of what they do, but at their basic, they often come into the country a couple weeks prior to the election, look at the polling places, the districts, how the workers, what ballots look like, things of that nature, as well as the counting. One of the particular challenges, especially with COVID, is, you know, usually when you think of election observers, that again, they show about a week or two prior, they stay a few days afterwards, and it's really the counting of the ballots and the physical handling of the ballots. That's much harder when you have early voting.
Yes.
And when you have absentee voting. So, you know, what used to be, say, I'll just throw out a 3-week period now becomes, well, perhaps it needs to be a 3-month period. And on top of that, with COVID, like just getting to the US, like the logistics of observers becomes much harder.
So as I'm thinking about that, not only has the pandemic made a problem, not has the early voting, I mean, even while Texas may not allow absentee balloting, except if you're over 65, they've now extended how long you can vote because they've actually extended early voting by an extra week. So that was kind of how they split the baby. You know, they said, okay, we'll give you an extra week, even though we won't let you vote absentee or by mail. But how do international poll workers do the mail-in thing? Because to me, unless you go into the postal service, unless you're able to sort of look at what's happening, it would seem that not only has the pandemic made it a little bit dangerous for them physically to protect themselves as they're monitoring these elections, but now the elections are happening in ways that are kind of out of sight.
It's certainly a challenge. So part of it is, you know, you can piecemeal not only, you know, sort of traditional firsthand observation with following social media in a country or news in a country and seeing what they're reporting on in terms of problems and investigating that sort of indirectly. But another option, you know, the focus does tend to be on, like, once the ballots have been received by an election commission, by the county, you know, office, like, how do they keep them secure? What's the process? And that's something that, you know, with early voting, with absentee voting, like, you could still do. Assuming, of course, that states and counties actually allow in international observers. And that's a big deal.
That was the most shocking part of the story, is that you talked about the states that do allow it, the states that might allow it, and the states that don't allow it. What the hell with states that don't allow it? I thought transparency is a celebration of democracy. And why the heck would a state say, you can't come in, international poll worker? I would want to celebrate what I do. But for some reason, there are some states that don't allow it.
And this surprised me too, because, you know, the original idea about the conversation piece actually came out of some work with two of my former students. And they were the ones that really, you know, pushed this notion of, like, you know, how do we look at observers and what do we even know about observers? Because most of their experience was, again, looking at Eastern Europe, for example. I think a lot of people don't realize that it's really up to the states and there could be wide variation. Now, I can only venture to say why a state would not want observers. You know, it could be that, like, you're concerned about, like, small things that are otherwise inconsequential, that observers might nitpick about things that, like, don't affect the outcome, but, like, just the style. Or, some of the European commissions, for example, have harped on the Electoral College, which has really nothing to do with the sort of transparency of the election. So, like, that you might just not want to hear that again. Some of the international commissions, you know, there can be representatives that are not necessarily, most of them are from democracies, but, you know, Russia occasionally will send someone. So perhaps that,
like, they're already here, Russia. Russia's already here. I mean, they don't even need an observer. They actually have an observer in the White House. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but that's their observer. I just want a level playing field.
but this notion that, like, it may be that you're hiding something potentially, or it could just be that, like, distrustful of others asking in the about these questions. My bigger concern is if you look at the states that explicitly say no, they're mostly southern states. Many of them might be competitive. Think Florida, for example. And you can imagine a situation in which, you know, even having a handful of observers would simply go, like, I think this might be a problem, or, like, perhaps we shouldn't be doing this as they're coming in, that you could actually nip some of these things as opposed to creating a bigger problem.
So let me quote from your wonderful article, because this was the part that I was completely shocked by. And now I'm going to sort of ask my state, maybe we need to write some legislation for this. And you wrote, since U.S. elections are run by the states, states decide whether or not to permit international election observers. Several of them, and this is, of course, no surprise to me, California, Missouri, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C. have laws that allow for international observers. They actually have laws that say, yeah, you can come in if you're in. Additionally, Hawaii, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Virginia have laws that allow election observers that could apply to international monitors. But most states either do not welcome international observers. The practice is explicitly, this was blew my head, explicitly prohibited by Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Connecticut. Oh, yay, we got to talk to Connecticut. Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Ohio, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas. I really got to talk to Connecticut. That's all I have to say. They're like an aberration in this list. But that they would actually have it on the books, that they would not want international observers. I got to ask you, as you were putting together this article, I don't know how much research you did about when those statutes appeared on the books, who sponsored it, and what the hell was the rationale for it? Because I think it's time for a come to Jesus moment, and I think we need to reintroduce this legislation, because if you support transparency, you want to be a model for the world, I would want to invite observers, one, because it would support my sense of trust, and two, it would help make sure that I did, you know, dot my I's and cross my T's.
I was rather surprised that there were so many that explicitly opposed them. And my understanding is that, you know, international observers really weren't a thing in the US until after 2000. So they're fairly recent. Okay. Because my initial reaction looking at the list was, okay, maybe this has something to do with Jim Crow laws of the 60s,
something like that. 1950, exactly.
Yeah, that's what came to mind. And like, I don't have evidence of that. So I'm a little hesitant to say that's the cause. It could simply be a concern about, you know, what international observers will ask, or why are they here, or for that matter, the cost of, like, you know, the logistics of having them around. So it could be as simple as that, but it certainly doesn't encourage transparency.
All right, so Ken, you want to ask a question?
Yeah, just, I understand the Southern Jim Crow era, but what about just general voter suppression? I mean, Georgia, for instance, in the last election, the Secretary of State counted
Florida and
in charge. Florida, Ohio often has issues with I remember the Secretary of State there as well, interfering. Maybe it's less about their history of Jim Crow racism and more about their voter suppression, which includes a racist element, but it's different than the segregationist history.
Well, I think that's your point from 2000, is like they started perfecting the art of suppression.
Right. But once Citizens United says that the Justice Department isn't going to pre-clear all of these changes to election voting policies, then no holds barred. They can go and make all these changes and nobody can stop them.
No, I would certainly agree that, like, that a state that is either, you know, engaging in voter suppression or is concerned about accusations of voter suppression might be less likely to want to have observers. And to be fair, it's not clear how many observers you need for them to be efficient, frankly. You know, is it one per state? Do you have any dozens? Where? A lot of those things are the real challenges. Like, even if you allow them in, like, how long are they there? When are the problems in cities versus counties? Like, do you know that in advance? You might know that in advance if you happen to know, like, the local conditions, but as an international observer, you might not know any of this until a couple hours before you arrive. Like, that's a problem.
So I have a couple of questions. We already know that there are going to be observers anyway, because there's a whole flank of lawyers ready to show up on both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Democrats that also look, and as you're checking off the box, there's a Democrat and a Republican looking over your shoulder anyway. We got observers coming out of our yin-yang. I mean, so we got lots of observers. I think what's so interesting about the poll is that when you polled people about international observers, the fact that it was so overwhelmingly supported kind of says they do want someone that's not an R or a D. They do want someone that's not been hired as a lawyer by an R or a D. They want another set of eyes. And I thought, again, what was so celebratory to me was like 65% of Republicans said that. You know, I expected 65 to 75% of Democrats to say it, because That's their argument. We like transparency. Of course we want this. And they have no problem. They're less, I think, xenophobic, to be honest with you. But when I saw Republicans wanting that, despite the drumbeat of Donald Trump, who keeps saying you can't trust it, and basically he's going to tell you the result no matter what the result is, the fact that they wanted someone else to confirm it was, to me, a positive about the fact that democracy still has a chance.
No, I was very surprised by this, that it was clearly bipartisan. Those who are independents are said nothing about being a Democrat or Republican, same about two-thirds, three-quarters. It wasn't an urban-rural divide, because I thought perhaps there were other aspects, you know, little things like that. Really, no matter how you parse it out demographically, majorities support it. And I thought that surprised me, because, you know, going into this, you know, my students really designed the question, so I have to give them credit. I was thinking that there would be a very clear partisan divide, that Democrats should be more supportive, Republicans wouldn't. We also found two other things that that are intuitive, but really also speak to this particular election and observers. So one, if you were concerned about international interference in the election, regardless of partisanship, and Democrats were more likely to say yes that they were worried about than the Republicans, you wanted international observers. If you're worried about contracting COVID as well, you were more likely to want international observers. And like the logic there might simply be that like, okay, I'm worried about COVID. I'm more than likely going to vote, if possible, by mail or absentee. And I'm concerned about, like, it's not the COVID election. It's rather the intersection of how my ballot is going to make it there. And is it going to count it?
Right, right. I just think, so tell me a little bit about international observers. Having never been one, having never met one, how the hell are they trained? How are they picked? I mean, how do you know, so for the states that, for example, embrace the concept of international observers, I mean, do you have like a Rolodex of international observer organizations and you get to pick whichever one? I mean, how does this thing actually operate? I'm even trying to imagine who shows up, how skilled they are, and where you go to find them.
Okay, this can range wildly. So like there's no sort of cookie cutter. So it can range from, you know, a lot of the European organizations, they're largely picked by, you know, election experts or those who have actually worked in the, like, election commissions at home.
Okay.
So a lot of them have sort of that technocratic experience. Cool. In other places, it might be a broader selection of I don't want to say the broader population, but like those who are interested in elections, or those, for example, more like myself that teach on elections, might be in that sort of group. So it can range quite a bit. In most cases, there are those that have experience at least in one, if not multiple countries, observing right. elections, right. Either domestically or like in Europe, within Europe. The closest of my own examples. So I do a lot of work in East Asia. So I've been to Taiwan a lot for local elections and national elections. And it's not that difficult to get an observer pass as an individual, as in a group, to Taiwan, because they want to show off their transparency. So like you can go, you know, you can go to the precincts that are everywhere. There's a precinct for about every 1,000 people. Like they're just everywhere.
Are you kidding?
They're everywhere.
Oh my God.
So they're everywhere.
Right, keep going.
Okay. So they're like, you know, I remember from where I was living, I could see one precinct and I could kind of think I could see the second precinct. Like they were, you know, a couple blocks away sort of thing. But you know, once the polls close, there's a few minutes where like they clean up a little bit. And then like you can sit there and you can watch them pull out the ballots and count them. Because like there's a separate ballot for president, for the legislature. So it's not one ballot. So it's right. very easy. They hold it up if it's properly stamped, you know, for candidate one, they put it on the board. If there's a mistake, you voted for everyone, it's debated right there. Don't count it. Or if it's like on the border, you'll hear a supporter go, that should count. Wait. And they stop right there.
Wow.
So in reality, the number of ballots that are blank or invalid for some reason, we're talking a fraction of a percentage. There's very few. But you can sit there and go like, I know exactly how people, at least in this precinct, voted. Bam. Wow. And it's done quickly. Like I was there for legislative presidential elections in January, in a matter of, you know, I don't know, an hour or so, you knew the precinct, like you knew the results for at least that precinct, not for the county, not for the nation yet, but you knew that.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm looking at going into the future. I want to be one of those states that allows international viewers of the voting. And I want to encourage every state to embrace this idea, because I think part of it, especially with your polling numbers, it really does say whatever we can do to reinforce trust is something that behooves those that are elected and the idea of why you should participate in the franchise. And it appears to me that people are yearning to trust it. They want to trust the results. And in a way, by embracing the idea of these international observers, you're actually not only embracing the idea, but you're actually saying that in the future, you may not need them, but right now you do. Because the one thing we know going into this election is there is so much distrust. There is so much fear. Everyone is worried about, do I have to physically show up despite COVID on election day? I mean, I said to someone the other day that I want Donald Trump to lose every way possible. I want him to lose in the polls. I want him to lose in mail-in voting. I want him to lose on election day. I want him to lose on the day they count all the votes. I mean, it needs to be a trifecta. You know, I want him to win nowhere, because if he actually shows some kind of a pulse anywhere, he will claim victory. And that means that the integrity of the result be challenged, because he already told you he's going to challenge it. So I think the idea of having these outside eyes looking at it is good for everyone, because they ultimately need to figure out who to trust. And right now, our current set of politicians are not people you trust. Isn't that sad?
No, I would totally concur that, like, it creates a sense of transparency and, you know, live to fight another day. At least I know that I lost, and I lost fairly. I think one of the things that really sticks out in my mind that, you know, like a worst case scenario, imagine a state or a county that releases the results of the early voting as soon as polls close, bam, at 6 or 7, but then release the day of voting as they go. Well, to the public, you could be looking at it and go like, oh, well, you know, my preferred party, we'll stick with Democrats voting early. Oh, it's 60-40 by the end of the night. It's not. Well, what happened? Like, it can create that. I know in some of the primaries, this was actually an issue, that like some counties were releasing differently than other counties and creating a sense of like, who won, or like, is this fair? Or like, oh, like, why are there so many ballots that I wasn't expecting in this county? Those little things, those logistics really become the challenge.
And what you're telling me is now I need to be more aware of the logistics need to be looked at through statute, that we can't have the release of early numbers and then the release of, you know, voting in person, that really what you really want to do is you want to release the final number, and that the final number is the number of the vote. The early number is not the vote. The number on election day is not the vote. The vote is the total vote. And yet, I don't think we have anything in writing that sort of gives people guidance as to when do you release numbers, and can they trickle out? Can you give them this piece by piece by piece? And in the end, given how frightened we are about what's going to happen on election month or election day, is that we haven't prepared for this. And this is both a teachable moment about what we need to do also for our voters so that they can trust the results. We just never thought that we would be challenged in this way. And again, I think that's why the embrace of the international poll workers is, because they are what we haven't done, which is figure out exactly how to ensure that integrity.
Go ahead.
Ken.
I was just going to ask about the international polling community. Is there some kind of agreement among them as to what best practices are, especially in terms of how much those best practices would be something that they would insist on doing? I mean, let's say Jimmy Carter and his election monitoring team come to any country in the world, and the country says, well, we're not going to let you look at this, or we're not going to let you look at that. Or as you were saying, Tim, in Taiwan, they let you go and look at counting every single ballot. But when they say no to the international observers, how much does that get actually held against them? Or can they just tell people tough luck?
Now it's perfectly acceptable in many of these cases for, you know, local officials to say, sorry, no. But election observers are pretty quick to say, like, these are the irregularities that we saw. Right. Like a more recent example. So just last year in Bolivia, you know, a presidential election that, you know, while the ballots were being counted, they just stopped counting publicly, and it wasn't on television, and Evo Morales a couple hours later, because you needed at least 50%, otherwise there was a runoff. He was at like 48, and then suddenly he was at like 52, like once the and observers were like, yeah, that's not the thing. fact, like the international observers are really credited for pushing this, that like we saw all of these things, and including the results that were coming out, they seemed like oddly inflated, and perhaps other suggestions of an electoral manipulation that they're used to seeing. So, you know, it gets kind of technical at that point, but like that really encouraged the opposition and even others in Latin America to say, we aren't going to recognize this.
Thank you. The conversation article is entitled, "As Concerns Mount Over Integrity of U.S. Elections," trust me, they're mounting, "so does support for international poll monitors." We've been talking with Professor Timothy Rich from Western Kentucky University. He's a political science professor with a focus on electoral reform. I want to go to Taiwan with you. I want to be able to see the, like, you know, from one district to another, that they're so quick, they're so fast, there's so many of them. The idea of so many is such a celebration of the franchise. And that's what I think I regret, is that in so many states now, we're seeing fewer and fewer places to vote. And that obviously is intentional. Thank you so much for teaching us about this. And I'm gonna see if I can get some legislation in my state of New Hampshire, and maybe places that are listening to this interview will do the same thing. Anyway, good luck and thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Whoa!